Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on list.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
And joining us now is the author of the new book, Raising Humans in a Digital World, Helping Kids Build a Healthy Relationship with Technology, author Diana Graber. Thank you so much for coming on to KMOX.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Raising humans, raising tiny humans, too. It's a weird world they're going to grow up in. It's a completely different way to grow up than when I was growing up, even. And my son is 4, and it's you can already tell that if there's a opportunity for him to use the iPad to FaceTime with the grandparents who live without a state, man, he takes every opportunity he can get. Those things are so addictive.
You know, they really are. I mean, they have addictive qualities for sure, and it is a different world. I mean, you know, when we were growing up, there weren't these bright, shiny objects that could connect us with the whole world, you know, on every table and every pocket. So, I mean, we have to adapt to it and have a completely different parenting style.
Yeah, and that has changed a lot of ways people handle their parenting with their children. And it's got to also, I guess, the ways they learn, too. Just now we're starting to teach our son how to read. And there's so many different resources for learning that's out there. Some of them want you to do apps. There's this one book we're using. It's like Learn How to Read in 100 Lessons. It's a pretty popular one. But there's people, like parents will just go to apps. They'll say, here, I'm just going to turn you over to this app. And I'll let you do your parenting from there. I'll let you learn whatever you need, and you'll be good. It's almost like they treat it as a hands-off solution sometimes.
Yeah, and that's something I really write a lot about in the book. I address the whole first section to people like you that have the younger kids, and I call it building a strong foundation. And I really argue that, you know, while there's a lot of really wonderful things that come to us via our devices and wonderful learning apps, et cetera, you know, those early years are so foundational as far as building interpersonal skills and face-to-face communication skills and the ability to read emotions and feel empathy and all those really important things that really can't be learned from a screen. And, you know, I think once a child develops those really strong social behavioral skills, they'll take those wonderful skills into the online environment, and it'll really serve them well when they start interacting with faceless others, with people with different positions or beliefs. Mm-hmm. You know, they really need those skills, and I argue that they're best learned face-to-face.
Yeah, and then when the kids get older, right now, Fortnite's very popular. They'll sit and they can play a game for a long time, and it'll suck them in. You know, hours is like a short session. And when you're playing games like that, but it's the same thing that all their friends are playing. It's almost like it's socially but unsocial at the same time because they're not doing it together. But it's something because they're all playing the same game, and hours could pass by and you wouldn't even see your kid. You wonder, oh, they got to be upstairs playing the game or something like that. It just sucks them in there too. It doesn't matter what age.
Right. And, you know, like you said, I mean, there's some wonderful things about connecting online with your friends. I mean, that's where friendships are happening, especially for young boys. But the thing about devices is they're built to capture and hold our attention. Fortnite does a great job at that because it's really hard to walk away in the middle of a Fortnite game because you've got teammates depending on you. But I think it's important to, you know, point those things out to children to show them the addictive qualities that the devices have built into them so that they can start understanding how they like to hold on to their attention. Because once kids understand that, they become a little more mindful of it. I mean, no kid likes to be controlled, whether it's by a parent or a device. But you do have to point out to them how the devices are taking their time.
Yeah. So have you played Fortnite before?
I have.
Oh, what'd you think?
It's fun. I can see what kids like about it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if I were, younger and I had all my friends on Fortnite, I think it would be really, really hard for me to walk away from it.
Mm. From the book Raising Humans in a Digital World, the new book out now, you can check out from Diana Graber. Well, I wanted to talk to you about setting the boundaries. So how do you even set these things up with a kid so it's not a fight when you say, turn it off?
Right. Well, there's a few ways to do this, and it's really dependent upon age. And one thing that I point to in the book are the age suggestions by the American Academy of Pediatrics. So those are outlined for every age of the child. And, you know, I think as parents, we have to remember that that kids like guidelines and boundaries, and it's our job to set those up, especially like we just talked about, when the devices are so good at holding on to their attention. So, you know, they still recommend for children 18 months and younger, no screens at all. The recommendation for kids 18 months to 2 years is that if you want to introduce your child to a screen, make sure you do it together with your child and that you explain things with them as they're doing them. And then they stayed away from actual time limits for older children, but they do recommend that it should never interfere with the daily basics of life, such as eating, sleeping, having dinner with your family, getting homework done. And that's where our kids need boundaries so that they get those other essentials in.
You see the new big game everyone's talking about, Tetris 99?
Yeah, oh my gosh, don't even get me started on that one. I used to be a big Tetris fan.
I know. I remember when the Game Boy came out, it was the only reason my parents would allow us to get one because my mom liked Tetris. And it was that's because the only reason we bought one in the household, we had to fight her for game screen time. You know?
I know. Well, it's, you know, it just goes to show you, you know, things really haven't changed, you know, honestly. The devices are changing and they're getting better and there's more of them, but it's still the basic parenting things. We still have to set boundaries for our kids, help kids understand what the rules are, help them have a healthy life, and that means balancing all the things they do, their screens and their non-screen time.
Yeah, and we want our kids to be good. We want our kids to do good. We want them to be put into situations and come out ahead where they don't feel like they have to buckle into the pressure. And technology makes it difficult for that because there's so many outside influences. There's so many predators and different people that are trying to hassle them. And then there's their other classmates that may be cyberbullying them, things like that. How do you talk to a kid about those sort of pressures that are also there in technology?
Well, I talk about that a lot in the book as well. In addition to the book, I have a program called Cyber Civics, and it's a digital media literacy program that we teach in schools all over the United States. But basically, it covers all those topics, cyberbullying, predators, online privacy, your online reputation. And, you know, there's a lot a kid has to know. I mean, the online world is super complex. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's important to carve out time, whether it's with your family or in school, to talk about these different parts of online interactions. You can't really throw your children to the wolves with this stuff when they're too young. Mm-hmm. That's another reason to kind of wait till they're older, especially if you're going to let them use social media where they're interacting with others and they may encounter cyberbullying. I have some smaller activities in the book called Cyber Civic Moments, mm-hmm. and they're family activities that families can do together to teach their children about cyberbullying and privacy and reputation and all those things. So I really suggest that both families and schools make time for this.
My goodness, maybe the parents will learn a thing or two about privacy, too, all the things that are posted on there. What's the right age, really, to not only have these talks, but I know that there's going to be kids in the class, and the kid, your son or daughter's going to come home and say, well, little Johnny's got the access to the Facebook, or little Johnny's got the smartphone, why can't I have it, too? And you may think it's a little early for them to have it. That seems like those conversations are going to come up a lot, pretty much in every kid's growing stages. So what is the right age to start talking to them about this, and what's the right age to give them permission to do things like social media?
Well, you're right. Very young parents are going to start hearing everybody has one. And I think it's important for parents to remember, you know, that's a kid talking, so not everyone's going to have one, right? But secondarily to that, the time to talk about this stuff is the minute you put a connected device in their hand. And that talk should happen often and early. But as far as what is the right age, it's important to remember that nearly every social media network out there, Snapchat, Instagram, Facebook, all of those require users to be at least 13 years of age to use the app. Mm-hmm. And that's really important because a lot of kids will sign up earlier. It's super easy to do. They just have to give a fake birth date. And any kid, 9-year-olds, can do that very mm-hmm. easily. But, I mean, there's a lot of good reasons to wait to 13, number one, because that's the rule. And number two, it really takes that long for a child to build their ethical thinking skills, and those skills are really needed when they go online.
Yeah. You know, if someone wants to check out some of these topics you cover in Raising Humans in a Digital World, where can they find the book?
It's available everywhere books are sold. Probably the easiest way is just Google it, and, you know, you can find it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all those good booksellers.
Love it. Kids, and I love schools that incorporate into projects like blogs or vlogs or podcasts and things like that. It's kind of fun to see kids try the creative side of the internet, but you got to be careful there too, because as soon as they start creating content, that's where it seems to draw the attention from people you don't want to draw attention from. So how can you encourage them to be creative and do things online and at the same time make sure that their privacies are paramount?
Well, I'm so glad you brought that up because, you know, a lot of times parents will worry about the dangers and forget about all the positive uses. And mm-hmm. you're right, there's wonderful creative things that kids can do online, and they are doing online. But again, you know, what I caution is just to wait till your children are a little bit older to do it with them so you know what they're doing and you can kind of guide them online and give them your wisdom that's so needed. And then also, you know, really talking to them throughout the year so that they understand, you know, the consequences to their reputation or to their privacy or to anything else before they start using these wonderful apps and tools that are available online.
I don't think they think about consequences. I mean, many adults don't think about the consequences to the things they post, too. That's difficult to try to convey an idea of permanency to a child.
It's really, really hard, and that's the, one of the lessons I have in the book, and it's a shorter version of what we do in the classroom, is that rather than lecture a child, I recommend doing case studies and scenarios with them. And so I have a little game in there that parents can do with their children where they observe how others have acted online, and you evaluate their digital reputation. So it's kind of like stepping back and seeing the consequences of someone else's actions. And I think that's really powerful because you're right, kids don't think consequences often. And the way it is when you're online, you do things in the moment because it's exciting and you take a picture and you post it. And so the activities that I offer in the book help families know how to, you know, kind of counterbalance that and give their kids some tools so that hopefully they'll think before they do something they regret online.
I know. All right, so the book is out called Raising Humans in a Digital World. You can find it everywhere. Do a search for it, or you can look on Amazon. Author Diana Graber, thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thank you so much, and good luck with your own family.
Oh, thank you. She joins us on the Quiver River Electric Guest Line on KMOX. Welcome back to Overnight America. Yeah, we have a live guest coming up in about 8 minutes from now. His name is James McCann. In fact, he is, I had to double check. I got my countries mixed up. He's vacationing in Switzerland. It is 8:23 a.m. in Switzerland, and he's going to join us for a morning interview for him. Very early morning interview for us here in St. Louis, which is actually pretty cool. We get to take advantage of the time changes. Not often do we get to do that. I wonder if we could ask him if he's got a radio while he's vacationing. Turn on 11:20. I wonder if he could actually hear us in Switzerland. Stranger things have happened. Yeah, that happens every once in a while. Maybe we'll get lucky. Producer Ben, when he calls in here during the break, ask him if he's got a radio in his hotel room. Because if he does, have him put on 11:20 a.m. Maybe he will get the signal over there. Wouldn't that be something? We can hear ourselves live in real time. So we're going to talk to him about the future of technology. Obviously, I'm going to talk to him about killer robots. Why wouldn't I? Elon Musk seems to think it's going to be a giant problem. Killer robots should be banned to prevent them from wiping out humanity. Scientists are warning right now. So backers include UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who has called autonomous weapons politically unacceptable and morally repugnant. Says killer robots should be banned to prevent them from wiping out humanity, while full-blown asteroid soldiers remain the stuff of science fiction. Advances in artificial intelligence mean machines with the power to select the attacking of which targets without human input could soon be developed, which is creepy, scary and creepy. It's kind of like the self-driving cars where they could brake automatically on your behalf if they feel like there's going to be a collision, which I saw a video over the weekend, which was pretty remarkable. A self-driving car in traffic, and the feature turned itself on like that. And it stopped a car and prevented an accident from someone that ran a red light coming from the opposite direction. It's pretty crazy, isn't it? It's amazing how those things could work out. So we'll talk to our expert about that. And a lot of people are warning about these killer robots. I watched a video that was put together. This is from the Daily Mail. They didn't put together the video, but it showed a person that is very much into making sure we prevent ourselves from walking down this road where we won't be able to turn back because we'll be enslaved to the robots. And you know that movie by Alfred Hitchcock, Birds, where nothing, it didn't matter. If you're in a phone booth, the birds would crack their way through the glass and you're gone. Or if you're in a house, doesn't matter. Cracking through, they're going in. I think there's a book too. And of course, the story itself is pretty crazy if you think about it. Birds, 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 birds. Well, they did this short film about the almost the exact same storyline, except it was drones. So it was just like a college campus and a bunch of drones came swarming, and it showed a bad guy opening up the back of a giant van with no windows and out swarmed the drones, and it went into a classroom and started blowing up and stuff. And they were showing how these pieces of technology could be used by terrorists. And then he comes at the very end of this video with a warning.
I'm Stuart Russell, a professor of computer science at Berkeley. I've worked in AI for more than 35 years. Its potential to benefit humanity is enormous, even in defense. But allowing machines to choose to kill humans will be devastating to our security and freedom. Thousands of my fellow researchers agree. We have an opportunity to prevent the future you just saw, but the window to act is closing fast.
I don't know how you turn it back. How? Maybe we can ask our next guest about that when I bring up my Terminator question. You know, I got to ask him about it. You know, how will new technologies change the world? We'll talk about self-driving cars, autonomous cars. We'll also talk about innovations, things you can expect in the next 10 years, computers, self-driving smartwatches, which isn't a thing. It just sounds funny. Self-driving smartwatches. Live from Switzerland will come up next. And if you want to text a question in about technology, you can. 314-436-7900. It's Overnight America, KMOX. Welcome back to Overnight America. Well, how about this? A live guest joining us on Overnight America. How will new technologies soon change not just the world, your world? Joining us now is the author of Startups in the Tech Revolution, James McCann. Thank you so much for coming on live with us on KMOX. Oh, hi, James? James, can you hear me? Oh, no. I'll try that one more time. Hey, James. It's a strange thing. It's like I don't even hear the phone line right now. Oh, no, it dropped again. Ah, bummer. So was he having some connectivity issues? This might be him calling back in right now. Try this again. I hope this isn't what the whole interview is going to be like. All right, let's try this one more time. Hello, James?
Hello.
How are you?
Very good, and you?
Good. You know, we were bragging about technology, and then our phone lines won't even connect. So I don't know if we should be bragging too much. So from what I understand, you're vacationing in Switzerland, where it's 8:33 a.m.?
That's right.
Wow. Yeah. Thank you for joining us bright and early. Have you even had your coffee yet?
I'm drinking as we speak.
Oh, beautiful. You know, I didn't know if you had a radio there. You might actually be able to listen to us live on it. Our signal does carry, and sometimes stranger things have happened.
Well, you've also got TuneIn Pro Radio, so you can just listen to any radio station in the world.
Yeah, could do that. Well, so technology's soon changing our world. You're the author of Startups in the Tech Revolution. Tech is a hard thing to track anymore. It seems like things move so quickly. It also seems like the things that consumers want moves quickly as well. How do you stay on top of these things?
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, if you think in the sort of 50s and 60s, tech was really just about microchips and about them getting kind of smaller and faster and cheaper. But now it touches every aspect of our society. You know, and I think that's the most exciting but also the most difficult thing about the tech revolution, the second phase of it, because so much now is changing so quickly, and it's not like it's changing and then stopping. It's changing and getting quicker and quicker all the time.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's what your listeners have got to think about, is how are they going to set themselves up so that they can be successful, you know, tomorrow and the day after tomorrow, given that the world is changing as quickly as it is. And that was the reason for writing this book, was, you know, to help people to understand what's going on and help people understand how they can thrive in the new world rather than sort of suffering the new world. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Do you wear a smartwatch?
I do not, no.
Are you afraid you're being tracked? Are you someone that's really into digital privacies as well?
I have a pretty high awareness of how I'm being tracked, and you know, I'm pretty careful about which location services I authorize and when I turn them off.
Scary, isn't it? It seems like anything you download on an app, they always ask for things, and you say to yourself, why in the world would I give them permission to do this? But sometimes it comes as a default. I don't think people realize how easy it is for a company to sell all your information to a third party, and you didn't even know it was going on.
Well, I think it's also, yes, I agree with you, and I also think that's one of the biggest opportunities as we look forward, because the, you know, the tech revolution is creating tremendous amounts of wealth, and a lot of that wealth is coming from the value of data. And so the way we should think about data in the tech revolution is a little bit like oil was in the Industrial Revolution. And I think we've got to figure out how society and the people in society get their fair share of the value of that data. Because today, I don't think we are. I think it's being concentrated more and more in a very small group of companies and people.
Author James McCann joining us here in the book Startups in the Tech Revolution, live from Switzerland, where it's 8:36 a.m. there. I like that I got the conversion right, so I'm proud of myself. I have to say it a few times. So are you a fan of Elon Musk and the things he's doing?
I think that Elon Musk has got a really interesting vision on a number of topics about where the world's going. And I think that he is catalyzing debates in those areas. And some of them, you know a lot about, like the self-driving cars, but some of them around artificial intelligence and the dangers of it. Some of them around how the brain is going to interface with computers in the future, which get talked about less. And then obviously, you know, his two other big ones, I think, are his tunnel boring machine, which is a great idea, but we'll have to see if it works. And then, you know, the rockets going into space and eventually going to Mars, which I suspect was, you know, many boys and girls, you know, childhood dreams.
You left out the flamethrower one with his boring company, right? Well,
the flamethrower, I didn't see. That's a new one on me. But
yeah.
I suspect that may not be the biggest one.
No, but you know what I like about Elon Musk? He's willing to just do things. And it doesn't, it seems like it may not be as calculated as a lot of these other companies, but he is like a revolutionary type of guy. If it wasn't for people like him, we wouldn't be advancing a lot of the technologies we're seeing today. And I got to give him a lot of credit for the things he's been able to do. But, you know, he's also someone that raises the red flag, like you mentioned, for artificial intelligence, the way it's going, you know, the Terminator future. Do you think there's a chance we see computers weaponizing themselves and turning on humans?
There's a risk of that. I mean, I think much more scary than that, though, for me, is the risk of cyber wars being initiated. You know, many people who know about these things believe that the next big world war is likely to begin as a cyber attack by somebody on someone else. And the truth is that we today don't have the, you know, our predecessors in the 50s and 60s and 70s understood the risks of nuclear weapons and chemical weapons and biological weapons because they'd lived through two world wars in recent memory. We have not put in place those same kinds of rules and protocols around cyber and AI controlled weapons. and even privacy that we need for this new world. And the problem with the new world is it moves so quick. You know, the way that that legislators move is at 1/100th of the speed that the world's moving at, and the world's accelerating, and, you know, arguably the legislation's slowing down. So I think we do have a problem there, and we need to get some, you know, kind of rules of engagement, what's acceptable behavior, in place pretty quickly. And interestingly, there are two or three big nations that have held out from putting in place rules around allowing machines to kill humans without a human being authorizing it. And the U.S. is actually one of those countries that's refused to do that, ostensibly on the grounds of wanting to be able to protect themselves. But the reality is that it's a big step when you allow a drone to automatically identify a person and then kill them without a human being involved. You know, that's a big, big, big step for, you know, men and machines in the future.
Yeah, it's fascinating you say about how we're seeing cyber warfare in these rogue groups. I mean, we talked a lot about it during the past election. Was it just some dude in a guy's basement that was trying to influence the election, or was it something more sophisticated? We see China's heavily involved when it comes to trying to steal trade secrets from major companies. North Korea, you see a lot of hacking going on. You know, before, when I was growing up, it was, you know, my dad can beat up your dad type of tough talk. Now it's like our hackers can beat your hackers. Our hackers can stop our... There's like good hackers. There's bad hackers. There's so many different things that go into warfare in the future. It's just fascinating to me. And the rule side of it, too. You mentioned that we're not even on the same standard when it comes to how our rules are going to handle things. So let's talk about rules in general and self-driving cars, because there's also debates that, you know, some countries may adopt it, other countries may not. You think one day everyone's going to be in a self-driving car?
One day, yes.
Yeah? It's just going to be the worldwide standard?
It won't come as quickly as many people think. You're already seeing a lot of driver assist now that's making car driving a lot safer. Because the reality is that we human beings are very poor at driving cars. You know, we have a lot of accidents. 30,000 people a year get killed in the States driving cars. But it's going to come in probably in commercial trucking first, on the long-haul trucking routes, and then gradually work its way into, you know, the rest of driving society. But I do think that we'll find that, you know, 20 years from today, it will be viewed as, you know, dangerous when a human being drives a car in amongst all of these, you know, pretty well-controlled automatic vehicles that do a good job of getting people from A to B quickly and safely.
So one of the concerns they brought up about self-driving cars was the decision-making process of an unavoidable accident. And how does the computer make the decision of what it's going to do? Who's it going to protect? Is it going to protect you? Is it going to protect the person next to you? Is it going to connect that? Does that kind of play into the same sort of technology we're seeing when it comes to artificial intelligence? Without a human stepping in, it's all of a sudden making a decision on someone else's life.
That's true, you know, and the sort of the question you're asking is, if you've got one owner driving a car and the car brakes fail, should the car drive itself into a wall and kill the owner, or drive across a crossing and kill, you know, six pedestrians on the street? That's the sort of classic question, the sort of philosopher's question. The reality today is, if your brakes failed in your car on the way home, you'd have to make the very same decision. So this isn't, you know, it's not like a new risk that we're taking on. It's a risk that exists today that's just going to have to be addressed in a different way. And I think that you can easily put in place the rules and protocols to do that. You know, and I think you'll find that the government and insurance companies and car companies and tech companies are fully engaged in those conversations as we speak. Will they be international? I suspect not. You know, I think that each country, and perhaps even within countries, you know, local districts will be making decisions. But I think all of it is going to be, you know, kind of within a rules-based framework that will become the accepted protocols of self-driving cars over time.
The book is Startups and the Tech Revolution. Author James E. McCann joining us here on Overnight America. So what do you think are the biggest innovations we may see in the next 10 years that'll impact our day-to-day lives?
There are so many. I'll mention two that I think, you know, kind of excite and scare me in equal measures. One is genetic engineering. You know, a lot of people have only just started to realize the advances that have been made. There's a technology now called CRISPR-Cas9 technology that allows you to edit genes. You know, so that excites me in the sense that we can probably in the coming years start to cure many genetic conditions that are horrible for people. It scares me in the sense that you're, you know, what stops us then starting to want, you know, taller people, better looking people, more intelligent people, et cetera, and parents, you know, will be very tempted to do that, especially if their neighbors are doing it for their kids. That would be one. I think another one, which is, again, very scary but very exciting, is the whole interfacing of the brain with computers. If you think about, you know, how humans have interacted with machines, you know, we started with abacus, then we had punch cards, then we had a keyboard, then we had a mouse, now we have a touch screen. We're starting to get, you know, some better interfacing through voice. Mm-hmm. But the ultimate sort of end of that point of those interfaces is a direct connection between, you know, your phone and your brain, your computer and your brain, the internet and your brain. Mm-hmm. And those things are equally, you know, actually primarily funded by the military at the moment, DARPA, because they're trying to give, you know, limbs back to veterans who've lost them during the wars. They actually now have got it to the point where they have a disabled fighter pilot who can fly an F-15 with his mind.
Wow.
Wow. And so probably within that decade, you're now going to see, you know, pretty substantial advances in that brain-computer interface, as it's called.
That's pretty remarkable. So my kid's 4. He's going to see a completely different world by the time he grows up. I guess I don't need to keep that TI-85 calculator around. He probably won't need it by the time he's in high school, much like all my friends and I. It was required that we came to class with the, you know, $100 calculator, whatever it was at the time. All right, so if people want to check out the things you're doing right now, if they want to learn more about your book, Startups and the Tech Revolution, where can they find it?
It's on Amazon. Just type in Startups and the Tech Revolution. You know, I would like as many people to read it as possible. So actually on the Kindle version, it's only at $1 now, just to sort of wow, get people to be able to read it for nothing. And, you know, the key thing for families now, in particular families with kind of teenage kids, I would suggest, is to start to read about this stuff and understand what's going on. Because, you know, those children's working lives are going to be completely different from their parents. They're not going to, you know, choose a career, become an accountant, become a lawyer, and then stay in that track their entire lives. The world is going to move way too quick. They're going to have to reinvent themselves every 5 or 6 years. And it's important that parents understand that so they can be having that conversation with their children as the children are making, you know, big, big, big life decisions. And you know, hopefully my book enables people to just get in a couple of hours, because it's only a 130-page book, to read about it, understand enough, and know where to go next to find out more. Because if you're informed, I think you'd be very excited by what's happening and you'll see the opportunities in it. But if you're not informed, then you're going to get caught out by the new world, and potentially it's going to be a difficult place to live for people.
Mm. Did you ask your publisher if it's possible to download straight to your brain?
Not yet.
Before you know it.
In 10 years, if I'm ever stupid enough to write another book, in 10 years, then that probably will be the case.
All right. Well, enjoy.
You've seen too many Matrix films.
I know. Well, there's that and the Oculus. So we'll just put like a screen on your face. We'll just kind of like strap it on and it'll just project everything you need to know right in front of you. Could be one of those deals too. So you joined us on your vacation. You're in Switzerland. You're taking some time off in the morning to enjoy some coffee with us. I got to say, thank you so much for doing that, author James E. McCann. And thank you for hooking up all the way here in St. Louis, Missouri from Switzerland.
No problem. Thanks for having me on the show. Bye-bye.
All right. So cool, isn't that? He joins us on the Quiver River Electric Guest Line, where it is 8:48 a.m. in Switzerland. It's Overnight America, KMOX. No, it is President's Day. How about that? Kevin Colleen did a whole nother story on it. It is so good. So good. I got time. I might as well play it again. Kevin Colleen's whole nother story. What would you do if you had a time machine? I know what Kevin Colleen would do.
The waiting room was crowded with mothers and wives of Union soldiers who were facing charges of desertion, asking the president to pardon them. A few members of Congress there. One of them kept looking at my shoes, a pair of blue Sperry's that looked out of place in 1864. I had read back then it was easier to see the president, and it was true. After waiting in about an hour, the clerk called me over and asked, "What do you want?" I said, "I want to speak to the president about this." And I handed him a Lincoln penny that was in my pocket, dated 1994. Well, that got his attention. The president called me in, and there he was. No amount of Matthew Brady photographs can prepare you for the sight of Lincoln in 3D. He looked like he needed a milkshake or some sunshine. He was so thin and pale. I'd heard stories about he was the tiredest and saddest looking man on the planet. And it was true. He had the penny in his hand, and he gestured and said, "Sit down." And he said, "What is this?" "Mr. President," I said, I was just gushing with excitement, "I'm from the future, and I'm here to cheer you up. I want to tell you, the North wins the war. The Union stays together. The country becomes a world superpower. We defeat Hitler. We win two world wars. There's battleships and flying planes and horseless carriages. We've got rockets that send a man to the moon. There's a Civil Rights Act. Women get the right to vote. We have open-heart surgery, refrigerators in every kitchen, Coca-Cola, White Castle hamburgers, and more." Lincoln rubbed his jaw and called for security. A brisk soldier came in and, with a nod from the president, grabbed me from the arm to lead me out. But I turned to shout to him, I have to warn you, it's not all good. There's nuclear bombs and terrorist attacks in New York, the World Trade Center. And whatever you do, Mr. President, don't go to the theater to see our American cousin. Well, nobody believed me. And as you might expect, after the president's death, I was executed. Which is why, if you ever get the chance to go back in time on President's Day and chat with Lincoln, just pass on it. With a whole nother story, I'm Kevin Killeen.
That's so good. Oh, Kevin, I love those so much, so much. We only got a couple of more minutes. You know what was this weekend? The NBA All-Star Game. You know what everyone's talking about? The national anthem. Anthony Hamilton sang the All-Star Game National Anthem, and everyone thought it was terrible. If you remember the All-Star Game National Anthem last year with Fergie, she was, you know, she put her own spin on it, and she was trying to make it all sound very sensual, and a lot of people gave her a hard time for that. I didn't think it was the worst thing I've ever seen. I mean, we lived through Roseanne, which was the most disgusting rendition of the National Anthem that any performer has ever disrespected. But Anthony Hamilton, I haven't actually listened to this yet. You want to hear Anthony Hamilton from the All-Star Game? Here, let's do it. So imagine it's a packed stadium. There he is right in the center court.
Anthony Hamilton!
I play him like he's about to run out and pull off of it. Two guys with guitars behind them.
Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars the perilous fight and the ramparts we watched was so gallantly streaming, and the rocket's red glare, the bombs bursting. That our flag was still there.
and the home of the brave.
That was Anthony Hamilton. He had two musicians behind him playing the acoustic guitars. Why are people saying that was bad? I thought that was great. Anthony Hamilton, I thought he did an excellent job. Definitely different, but man, I liked it. Why is everyone saying that's terrible? Are you kidding? Oh, I thought he did an excellent job. Wow, I guess that's what happens when you just read the internet and you don't look for yourself. Whoa, I gotta say, Anthony Hamilton, you did an excellent job. I don't know who Anthony Hamilton is, but man, did he do a great job. I'll say, no, any people that are hating that out there, give me a break. Come on. That was actually really good. All right, that does it for us here on Overnight America. We'll be back again tomorrow night starting at 10. Don't forget, you can download this very show anytime, anywhere, wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Overnight America. Click that subscribe button on it. It definitely helps us. And oh, by the way, it's all for free. We'll see you again tomorrow night.
Vehicle's engine with a full synthetic oil change and save with Mobil 1 at O'Reilly Auto Parts. Purchase 5 quarts of Mobil 1 full synthetic motor oil and receive a $10 O'Reilly gift card after rebate. See store for details. With your Mobil 1 purchase, you'll also receive 2x points during Old Rewards Bonus Points Month at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Oh, O'Reilly!